Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here with Thomas Harper, and we're going to talk about Infinity War. Thomas, how you doing tonight?
I'm lost and confused. Normally I talk Star Wars, but suddenly I've been thrown into the MCU, and so I have no choice but to accept this duty assignment.
It's a good place. It's the other big Disney property, and it's lots of fun, and it's, you know, 19 movies and more coming. So Ant-Man and Wasp being number 20 coming out
19.
In July.
That's crazy. Normally they talk to you about like things that make you feel old, like AOL Instant Messenger going the way of the dino, or whatever the newest social media thing is now. But knowing that I've sat around for 20 Marvel movies, that's jeez.
Over 10 years, so they've averaged basically 2 a year.
Yeah.
Good pace. No, I love them all. I mean, I grew up reading Marvel comics, seeing my childhood, you know, characters that I beloved come to life on the big screen is a ton of fun. And with this big arc, you know, this was the godfather of superhero movies. And people are emotionally traumatized after it. So
there were children and adults alike in my theater that were weeping at the end. You don't see that very often with people. I didn't see crying like that when Han Solo got impaled, and I love Han Solo very dearly. But it was a really powerful movie. I thought it was, you know, if you're going to build to something over the course of 19 movies, this was the thing to build to.
Brilliantly executed. To have a movie with that many characters and pull it off successfully, that is masterful storytelling, because everything fit. And with the way they mix matched characters that we haven't seen together before, it fit nicely and it was fun. And yes, the end is a bummer, but it's the middle of the story. They're called the Avengers for a reason, and there's a lot to avenge right now.
Yeah.
And it presents a bunch of good legal issues as well. But it's not a feel-good movie like the original Guardians of the Galaxy, which still dealt with a whole bunch of trauma. All those characters have huge loss and suffering to, say, Captain America the First Avenger, which, again, good World War II story, brilliantly done. But each one, this was a wonderful build-up. It's the middle. People shouldn't lose faith, because the heroes will come out of this. Now, I don't know what the final body count will be, but, you know, it ends with the original Avengers are the ones left intact with a few other characters. But we can talk about the plot in a little bit. Now, for those who haven't seen the most highest grossing superhero movie of all time yet, turn us off and go watch. It's good. It's worth it. Okay, so there's going to be lots of spoilers now.
I'll forgive you if you go watch Solo, A Star Wars Story first, but definitely still go see Infinity War.
Exactly. You're going to want to watch this. So let's talk about the big issue, and that's, how would you prosecute Thanos? You're a JAG officer. Granted, you're now out of active duty. But let's talk about how we would put together the case to prosecute him, and why it's important to prosecute him as opposed to simply behead him.
I first want to see the pair of handcuffs that have been crafted to hold Thanos and restrain him, because those have to be the most impressive set of human engineering possible. But
or Dwarfin. You know, they're good.
I'm assuming that I'm one of the, you know, 50% of the, you know, prosecutors on Earth, I guess, that have survived his finger snap. Hopefully there's like one defense counsel left for Thanos.
Yeah, we should talk about the death wave in a minute. But yeah, so 50% of life in the universe has been wiped out. And I don't know if that's down to the cellular level, or if it was just civilizations. Because if it's all life, that means like an endangered species could be just half of what's left. You know, what was the mathematical calculation, or was it like just even across the board? or like what happened in different countries, like where different countries purge more than others.
Yeah.
You could literally have a change in geo landscape on Earth if, let's just say, that the United States didn't only lost like a quarter of the population, but something like China lost 60% of their people.
When you bring up, I'm sorry, you bring up an interesting question too, because obviously the loss of human life is very important, but you've got some countries that are uniquely situated in the sense, you know, I don't want to make like fun of it, but the animals are a big deal in a lot of endangered species are a really critical part of a lot of nations, and you know, the steps, the efforts, and the resources that their governments take to defend and protect these populations. And so I don't think you can write the prosecutor in me says you can't write off his crimes against that. I mean, you know, is it of the magnitude, is killing off, you know, half the remaining white rhino population or whatever, that on the same magnitude as like wiping out half of Africa? No, but you know, if I'm a representative of one of those nations, I don't want stuff like that to, you know, go by the wayside. And I think that's, you unpack that issue a little bit on a broad level. And that's one of the problems with prosecuting him, is like, you've got a lot of competing interests, right? So I don't know. You're going to have a lot of people chomping at the bit, a lot of nations chomping at the bit, a lot of worlds chomping at the bit to get a piece of Thanos. How do you handle that?
I think World War II is a good example, because people were chomping at the bit to go after the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Allies, you know, were planning to win the war. They were planning to fight until it was done. And they had begun talking at the different conferences where you know, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill got together, and there were others besides, you know, the big ones like Yalta and you know, the other meetings that took place with lower level folks. But you had the Moscow Declaration, which was, you know, like the stated intent to prosecute the Nazis, and there were some jurisdictional discussions there of people who were invaded or lost people, you know, to them. Then the second one was the London Charter, which actually got more nitty-gritty on how to actually do it. And I think you could come up with something similar in the MCU for being able to prosecute him. And what the Allies did was, the victors, as in the Allies, the countries that actually stopped Germany, put together 4-judge panels. And the panels would then elect what they called the president, you know, a presiding judge to rule on admissibility and, you know, make the trial go, and put together the outline for how they would charge them. And there were 3 crimes that could be charged, and that was defined in Article 6 of the London Charter. And they include crimes against peace, war crimes, which is violations of the customs of war, which get into murder, ill treatment, slave labor, all the horrible things. And then crimes against humanity, which was murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts against the civilian population. I think that would apply to Thanos. And while there's a touch of victor's justice in figuring out who would be the, you know, the powers that would have to band together to stop him, that we'll see in the next Avengers movie, that's at least a starting point, as opposed to just a mob going after him.
Yeah. I think you bring up a really good point with Nuremberg and the Tokyo tribunals, because at the time, for those that are unfamiliar, you know, this framework that Josh is describing was purpose-built for this situation. It's not as if the world didn't have a system or some mechanism in place to deal with war crimes generally or folks that, you know, violated international law. I mean, we came out of the ashes of World War I, and there was a general international consensus that something needed to be done. And so you had, you know, charters and whatnot that were drawn up. But World War II was unique. It was, you know, on a different scale than World War I, you know, maybe not in terms of overall deaths, but just in the scope in the, you know, I guess the spread of the destruction and just the, you know, World War One had a lot of killing. You didn't have mass genocide like you did in World War II. So there were a lot of unique things that drove the decision and the need to really build a custom solution to the problem that Germany and the Nazis presented. And I think Thanos is that same unique problem, because not only this isn't an Earth problem, this is a galaxy problem that he presents. And certainly folks from other planets out there in the MCU are not going to be okay if, you know, the United Nations on piddly little Earth decides to be the ones to try him. And I don't think it makes sense to haul him around from planet to planet to try him, you know, 1,000 separate times. So I think you probably see some sort of intergalactic body put together. And the unique thing about the London Charter and Nuremberg was that what Josh described there, the crimes of peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, think of those like the big three. I mean, you're talking major violations of the customs of war, major war crimes. You know, I talk sort of in jest about like charging Thanos for killing some rhinos, but you really want to boil it down to what's the you know, the most important stuff here, because what you don't want is Thanos on trial forever and the delay of justice for all the families and populations that are grieving out there as we prosecute him and prove up every single tiny little crime that he's guilty of. So if you focus on these big three, I think it's efficient, it's speedier, not just for Thanos as an accused megalomaniac, but you know, for all the victims involved.
I have memories of the Milosevic trial, like going on, yeah, and getting funky, and you know, him representing himself at one point and just being over the top crazy. And I would need to go back and look at it, because I was in college and law school while that was going on. Mm-hmm. But you don't want it to devolve into a funky show where you have Thanos arguing that, oh, no, what I did was justified and it was humane. We had to wipe out half of all life to conserve resources. It's like, who are you to play God? And right, that's the issue with war criminals, is they think they're doing the right thing. You know, you read the sick, twisted, disgusting views of the Nazis, and they believed they were right. I mean, mm-hmm, they didn't think they were the bad guys. And it's like, you sick monster. No one paths a road to hell thinking that they're the bad guy. And he clearly is delusional to that level of believing, no, what I did was right. Just as the disgusting creatures at Nuremberg and in the Japanese war crimes trials as well, who thought they were the superior race and what they did was, mm-hmm, completely justified. So there are those issues that you don't want to go crazy. It's important to remember that with Nuremberg, there was no legal defense to war crimes.
Yeah.
You know, like that, like strict liability type situation. I think that's what you could argue with Thanos, that it wasn't hate-based and it wasn't systematic and it wasn't racial. It was his calculus of where you have to reduce the population by 50%. So it's universal in scope. Mm-hmm. But would still qualify as genocide.
Yeah, I mean, it's pure extermination. I mean, it's wholesale slaughter on a scale that the galaxy's never seen. And I think you have to follow Nuremberg's model, and you can't give him a legal defense for that, because all of a sudden that what could start out as, you know, an attempt to protect due process or whatever, some you know, good intentioned effort, turns into Thanos recruiting from the witness box a whole new crew of flunkies for his army, another Voldemort looking character and whatnot.
Voldemort, and you know, the Nazis were charismatic and,
yeah,
maintained that in trying to impress their American, you know, guards and those who were, you know, detaining them, because they were trying to come across as suave and sophisticated. It's like, mm-hmm, you'll never forget, they're monsters. That what, yeah, they did was barbaric and don't fall for it. And that would be the issue with Thanos as well of, we're going to have to put you down. Like, what you did was absolutely wrong, and there's no justification for it because you're not God.
Yeah.
And you don't get to play one.
I think you called him in your article the galaxy's worst environmental terrorist, and there's no better way to describe Thanos than that.
Clearly, it's a big swing from the comics where he was the lover of death, literally. And in the original Avengers movie, with the mid-credit scene where, we have his lieutenant say, to go there as an Earth is to court death, and he turns and smiles with a grin. I had every belief at that point in time they were going with that view of Thanos, that it was the lover of death, that death is an entity. And, that's dark and sadistic and, has been brilliant storytelling, back in the Jim Starlin era of when the character was introduced. Because I do think it's wonderfully complex. This is a different form of evil, and it worked better as a movie, I feel. Because you have so many villains in the superhero movies, that just want to watch the world burn. And Thanos, he wants the world watch the world burn, but it's because he's trying to save life in his twisted universal view. And that makes him different. That puts him in the same level as, say, like Kingpin and the Daredevil series, that he's aggressive urban renewal. He thinks he's making it a better place. He's going to get rid of the ugly underbelly of New York. And it's going to be a place worth living in, and it's going to be beautiful. And he's convinced that he's doing the right thing, no matter how many crimes he's committing in the process. Thanos is up there, and which makes him different than, say, Ultron, which was, I just want an extinction-level event, or any of the other movies where we've just had, I want to watch the world burn. Now, Vulture in Spider-Man Homecoming was different with just trying to provide for his family. So they skipped the villain issue. He's not just someone who's trying to destroy the world. He thinks, I'm going to save the universe by doing this.
Well, yeah, and that's a really good point, because I think it makes him more compelling as a, if you think about this in the legal context, as a defendant. I mean, it's very easy to decide, hey, we're going to put somebody on trial, give him no defense, and send him off to whatever, hellish galactic prison we can devise to contain him, if he's just a literal manifestation of death. But if suddenly, not only does he have this twisted view that, if you twist your brain around in knots, you can understand, but if you also see that this view is informed, at least in his mind, by his own experience on his planet, his travels around the galaxy. I thought that you make a good example with Ultron, and I hadn't thought of this before until you brought it up, but Ultron sort of saw the same thing. I mean, he sees sort of all of humanity, I guess, as he comes into sentience, and he decides that humanity needs to go. The reset button needs to get hit. But there wasn't that same level of connection with Thanos. And to me, it didn't have anything to do with one's a robot and one's a living being. But just the way that I think Thanos's view, his twisted view, had gotten built. I think it's the difference between like Hitler and one of these, SS lieutenants or whatever, that had just grown up in the Nazi regime and have it doesn't make it any less evil, but this very complex justification for their view that's based on indoctrination and these twisted experiences that they've had. So to me, he was much more compelling than almost any of the other villains that have been out there. But I think it adds a layer of complexity when you think about him as a defendant, too.
Agreed. It also raises the issue that he's kind of a cult leader in what he's doing, because, he does have the Children of Thanos, and they kind of act like a church on some levels with their devotion to him. And he does look to them like they're his congregation or flock, mm-hmm. which is weird and creepy on so many levels. But it raises interesting issues of would we view him as a terrorist or a war criminal? Because war criminals are normally associated with a nation state, and he doesn't have one anymore, mm-hmm. but he has a following. What are your thoughts, putting on the prosecutor hat, of where would he fall in this?
I think you would have to expand. I think the definitions as they exist right now of terrorist and war criminal don't contemplate somebody like him that knows no borders and whatnot. And certainly I don't think the world has known sort of a nationless criminal with the kind of reach and destructive power that Thanos has. So I think I put him in the war criminal class, but I think you would have to expand the definition to account for somebody like that. I don't think you can easily hammer him into either one. The crimes themselves absolutely fall more into the war criminal side than terrorism.
Because it was an organized plan. Mm-hmm. It was not indiscriminate. He wasn't trying to get political change any place. Mm-hmm. It was literally just genocide. But he's definitely a fusion of the two, because there's overlap and differences. Because it's not pure terrorism, because it doesn't meet the definition. But he's not a nation state mm-hmm. either. But some of his goals would fall into comparable to a nation state as opposed to a terrorist organization.
You could put his big purple head as like its own circle in this three circle Venn diagram, and he like intersects with both. His giant chin intersects with both the other circles.
Yeah, because he's not trying to bring political change. I mean, no. Al-Qaeda, they have their goal of what they're trying to do, and same with ISIL, of what they want to achieve. Like there's a goal with him. It's I want to knock down the population by 50% and then go live on my farm. And it's like, no, like you don't get to decide that. That's not how this is going to end. So, and you don't get to kill people on the way just cause. So yeah, he's a wonderful villain. I mean, like there's a reason why he's one of the most popular and enduring villains, and they've resurrected him multiple times. But we can talk about the comic part of this after we get through the law.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the other big issue. You know, whether or not Vision was actually murdered by Scarlet Witch, and could Scarlet Witch be charged for his death? And that's a beautiful can of worms to dive into.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would mean Vision has to be a person in order for Scarlet Witch to be charged with killing him. And if he's not a person, could she argue the necessity defense?
Yeah, and it's so at the core of it, if you just look at the straight definition of murder, it's the unlawful killing of one human being by another. So to have committed the crime, and I don't know that we're going to get into this debate, but you've got to first establish that Ultron, the Vision is actually a human being and not some other entity, whatever you want to describe him as, whether he's a person, so to speak. I think if you get there, my defense hat goes on, and I look at the necessity of the killing and the threat that was faced at the time. I mean, Scarlet Witch didn't do what she did in a vacuum. They weren't in the apartment eating pizza together. They were staring down the imminent destruction of half of all life. And to me, faced with that sort of danger, I would argue that, there was some level of necessity there.
I have mixed feelings on it, because they went against one of their own core values when they decided to pull the trigger on killing him. And it was based on the idea that in order to preserve life, Vision must die, because that's the only way to destroy the Mind Stone. And, they talked about this throughout the film of not trading a life for a life. And be one thing if Vision sacrificed himself in fighting Thanos, or in order to destroy the Mind Stone, he flew into the sun or something of that nature to destroy it. That doesn't happen. He asked Wanda to basically do an assisted suicide move. And it's worth noting that there are only two Avengers that were able to take on Thanos, and that was Thor when he had Stormbreaker, and Wanda did it one-handed. That's how powerful she is. If they had not done, we're going to have to do the sacrifice play, but focused on, let's fix Vision so that way he can, you know, alter his density and be able to, you know, be in the fight as opposed to being severely wounded the entire time, that would have been within their core values. And the focus could have been on stopping him, getting the gauntlet off of him, you know, like what they tried on Titan, as opposed to, you know, like, we have what he wants, so he's going to come to us, so let's take the bastard on. That would have been within their core values and would not have been this Hobson's choice of I have to kill Vision in order to save the universe, because, you know, here's the guy. They didn't know he had the Time Stone, but knowing the other three stones that he had, it's like, we probably shouldn't take him on one-on-one. Excuse me, that point he had five out of the six. So if you go like, okay, we're going to assume at least he has four, but if he has the Time Stone, we're kind of screwed because he can play with time. So let's do a frontal assault, like, because that's, we're going to have to do this smart, and we're going to have to either cut off his arm or get the gauntlet off of him somehow.
Well, that's an interesting point. So if I think, and maybe that changes the calculus with the Scarlet Witch, does it matter whether she believes that he's one stone away, so he just needs the Soul Stone, or whether he's two stones away? Does that change the necessity calculus that much?
And we don't know how many stones they're aware of. You know, Banner was there for the briefing with Doctor Strange and Wong, so in theory they should have been aware, but they weren't sure of if he had the Reality Stone. Because that was on nowhere. And if you knew the location of the Soul Stone, and they knew Strange, you know, imputed knowledge from Banner that Strange had the mind, the Time Stone. So that just leaves Vision with the Mind Stone. So they know they got one out of six, and he already had two. And he was going out to acquire the other three.
Yeah.
So if she took the position, I know he has two, and we're not going to let him get a third, or worst case scenario, I'm going to assume he has five.
Yeah.
I don't think sacrificing Vision was the right call objectively from the get-go. Now, that would be my argument of just with trying to do battle strategy of this is against her core values. That I get we're trying to destroy this thing, but instead of destroying it, why don't we use it?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, let's stand our ground and fight. Let's put everything that we have into taking this thing down, you know, his army and him, and this is going to be a hegemic battle, as opposed to we're going to have the hegemic battle anyway. There's no way around this. This will be a hegemic battle. And if we lose, we're screwed. But let's do it on our terms with all of our resources and not writing off Vision, because we know he's coming for Vision.
Yeah, when before she even faced down the choice of doing that, I mean, their intent was, let's, regardless of how many stones he has in his possession, we can control the fate of one. And if we can destroy that, we know for sure that we can block him from getting all of them. And so I guess I can see both sides of the coin there, but, you know, under the specific circumstances that she killed him, you know, outside the shield and whatnot, I don't know. I'd be her defense counsel. Sign me up. I'd do a pro bono.
It's a good question. It's a very good question. Yeah, you know, because it comes down to battle tactics, and I believe their battle tactics violated their core values. And that was the compromise that cost them everything. Just as on Titan, it was Quill getting upset about Gamora that cost them that fight.
Right.
Now, on the flip side, you know, this raises the issue with Thor and the kill shot, because Stormbreaker is the only weapon that actually cuts through the Infinity Stone's magic, and he was able to actually harm him, and that was a near-fatal blow. And Thanos does say, you should have gone for the head. The head's a trickier shot. Like, police officers and in the military, and like, unless you're the sniper, no one's aiming for the head. They're aiming for the chest. That's the engine room. Like, that's
center of mass, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, that's the target to hit. So when you got the guy who has 5 stones, or at that point, 6, and it's not, hey, I'm going to try taking off the arm, because that's a narrow moving target, or the head, which is also small, comparatively speaking. That requires a lot of aim and energy. Now, in retrospect, Thor should have aimed for the head. I don't know if he could have hit the head. It's literally, you know, this isn't a hammer, it's a battle axe. And could he have pinpointed, hit the his skull? Now, Thor did go up to him to say, you know, to brag, I said I would kill you.
As somebody who has a head as big as Thanos's, I appreciate that you don't play up that fact, that you give him a little bit of credit that it's not so big. So,
yeah, it's tactically, yeah, but I don't know if practically it was possible. And I don't think Thor's intent was to be able to go brag. I think he wanted him dead with one shot.
Yeah. That'd have been a hell of a scene, wouldn't it? I mean, if you're in the middle of this movie and then Thor just beheads Thanos and then the credits roll. You're like, well, let's all go home.
That was awesome. Another time.
It's like a Snoke moment out of The Last Jedi. Like, holy hell, like, what just happened? Start playing soccer with it.
So we're doing the Gaddafi model. Okay, well, Libya model worked that time. All right, well, we're going to apply it here. That's, it was great kill shot, and but for the gauntlet, would have been effective.
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for the, I guess, reality stone, he would not have gotten back up. So. Yeah. And he did look injured still on his farm.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, he was not 100%. He went to gaze out on the sunset of a half-dead universe.
Yeah, he was hurting. Well, let's talk about the military issue of defending War Machine for hanging up on the Secretary of State, which what are your thoughts on defending Rhodey from prosecution?
So he hangs up the phone and he says, that's a court martial. And I appreciate any time that kind of lingo finds its way into any kind of movie, Star Wars, MCU, or otherwise. But I just wish that for once they would like reach out, because it sounds so catchy and it worked for the moment. But there's just very little basis for that kind of comment in reality. And, you know, movie aside, you know, entertainment value aside, Colonel Rhodes would have known better than to make a comment like that. I think he would have been totally fine to hang up. I think he would have had an absolute defense to it. The big issue is that, you know, a court-martial can be for federal crimes, for crimes under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but the specific crime that I think he was referencing, which is disobedience of a lawful order or disobedience of a general order, it's got to come from either a superior officer, so somebody superior in rank to him, or in the case of like the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, one of the department heads, you know, he's an Air Force officer, so the Secretary of the Air Force. They can publish their own rules and regulations that have to be followed. But Ross is the Secretary of State. I get it. He had an illustrious career in the Army, Medal of Honor winner, I believe. But his days of wearing the uniform and giving orders to junior ranking officers are long gone. I think Ross carries himself as if he's still wearing the three stars on his shoulders, but it doesn't give him the legal basis to give an order that needs to be followed. The caveat, the twist, and we don't know this, but you make a really good point about it in your article on this point, is if the Sokovia Accords built a chain of command that we don't know about that gives Secretary Ross the authority, that then opens a possibility. So that's what we don't know. But with what we do know and current law, he's not in a position. Certainly if the president had given that order to arrest or something like that, you'd still have some other issues to unpack. But if we're strictly speaking, you know, when do you have to follow the order of somebody? You know, it's got to be one of those folks, a limited number of civilians or a superior officer.
Yeah. One of the problems I had with that. The other one is posse comitatus, that you're now asking the Air Force officer to commit law enforcement acts and conducting an arrest. So that's an issue, that we're not seeing the U.S. Marshals called in to arrest Cap and company. We're seeing Rhodes. Now, maybe Rhodes has some authority under the Sokovia Accords that we don't know to conduct law enforcement, or maybe Congress carved out a provision for the Avengers to conduct law enforcement, and that's the hat he's wearing in order to conduct an arrest. But that necessarily doesn't end in a court-martial for him failing to follow the Secretary of State, because that's still not in the military chain of command, unless somehow it is under the MCU Sokovia Accord implementation with different enabling laws that come into play.
Yeah, and when what I don't want to open this can of worms before we need to, but what is he even arresting him for? The violation of an unconstitutional law or something? Yeah, so,
yeah, which wonderful way to bridge into the Fourth Amendment. You can't just say you're under arrest. It's you're under arrest for X, and we don't know what that X is. So, yeah. You know, Ross saying, no, I'm just a jerk, therefore I want you arrested. Well, that's not – that violates the law. So, no, thank you for playing. If it's – under arrest for violating the Sokovia Accords, okay, thank you for saying that. That gives Rhodes the option to say, well, I'm not following that because I think this is unconstitutional because of everything that's happened with secret submarine prisons that's without due process, and I'm not subjecting anyone to that because that seems to violate the law, and I'm going to stand here and we're going to argue that in court now. So I think that's a good strategy to challenge the Accords from a legal standpoint, which I don't think was his tactic. I think Rhodes was just going, no, you're kind of a jerk. No.
Well, it's worth noting too. So on the subject of courts martial, they are not like a normal trial. They functionally in execution, they look exactly like any other federal trial. And if you get convicted at a court-martial, it is a federal conviction of whatever statute that you've got. But the setup of one, how one comes to be, is very, very different than a civilian trial. Civilian trial, you're going to have an indictment, a grand jury's involved, a prosecutor, a district attorney, or a U.S. attorney of some type is making the decisions on what to take to trial. You know, it may be in concert with, you know, the district attorney or the actual U.S. attorney who's making or withholding decision-making authority on what to charge and what not to charge. But those are all attorneys driving the process, with the involvement of a grand jury in a lot of cases and whatnot to actually bring the physical indictment. A court-martial is very different. The system in the military of trials, the entire system of military justice is commander-driven. So it's not – no JAG officer, no military attorney, in other words, has any type of authority to say you're going to get charged and you're going to face a court-martial or a trial, in other words, over this conduct. So even if Secretary Ross were still wearing the Army uniform, he couldn't just decide or tell his JAG to go ahead and bring charges. That power to bring charges, to bring something physically to a trial, rests with commanders. And certainly Ross could be in a position to be a commander, but it would have to be one of Colonel Rhodes' senior commanders to bring that charge, somebody vested with the authority to do so. And not every officer is vested with the authority to convene a court-martial, but it would have to be somebody making that decision based on their authority and also making it independently. And I won't go fully into this rabbit hole, but there's such a thing as, it's called undue or unlawful command influence, UCI for short. And it's a unique aspect of the Army, that, or the military in general, that a commander making a decision on whether something goes to court-martial should be able to do so independently without having pressure from a superior officer. And if you guys listening remember Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, the very famous recent case, the Army sergeant that went, he was MIA, actually was our only POW in Afghanistan for a number of years, went missing in 2009, finally got released a year or two ago, and then ultimately faced court-martial for voluntarily going AWOL from his base in Afghanistan before he got captured by the Taliban. One of the core issues in that case, because a four-star general decided to send him to court-martial for it, but one of the core issues was the president's repeated comments, both on the campaign trail and in the White House, about the case and about his thoughts about the case. Everything from, you know, hey, if I were in charge, I would put Bo Bergdahl up against the wall and shoot him. The comments ran the full gamut. But what the defense argued again and again and again is that inevitably the comments of the commander in chief, or the person that eventually became the commander in chief, they can't be ignored by that commanding officer. So in their argument, that four-star general was undoubtedly influenced based on the actions of the president, because that's the boss at that level. As a general officer, the president's got an interest and a hand in and can step in and affect your career in different ways. And so this entire argument was that the president's comments in both capacities tainted the trial inevitably, because it tainted the commander. That's such a really unique aspect of military justice you don't see anywhere else, because there's just not the same. There's prosecutorial misconduct out there, but there's nothing like this sort of flavor out there. And ultimately, if you paid attention to the Bergdahl trial, the judge didn't outright say this. He refused to dismiss the case based on the defense's complaint of UCI. But ultimately, Bergdahl got no prison time for what he was convicted of, or what he pled to, rather. He received a bad conduct discharge, which is a heavy punishment, but no jail time. And I can virtually guarantee you, we'll never know this for sure, but I would bet a lot of money that those UCI comments factored in. And so to tie this back to the MCU, Ross may be seething angry after Colonel Rhodes hangs up that phone, but he has no vested power to bring a court-martial against Colonel Rhodes. And were he to get on the phone to one of Colonel Rhodes' superiors at Northcom or wherever and start to express his opinion that they needed to try, you know, put this colonel on trial, the defense would have a lot of the same ammunition that the defense in Bergdahl did, to say, look, I got it, Secretary Ross. You are very upset, and maybe rightfully so, but you can't leverage your influence on to influence this military justice process. So anyhow, I didn't mean to lead down a rabbit hole, but that was just a really unique aspect of this that, you know, you can unpack from that very short scene.
And well said, because that, again, all of those issues are there. I go to the issue of Rhodes potentially being court-martialed for not arresting Rogers, Wilson, Wanda Maximoff, and Vision for federal crimes, but that are not subject to the military courts. So again, weird issues there that, again, that's pure posse comitatus, because Rhodes would then be conducting law enforcement and then charged for not prosecuting law enforcement or executing law enforcement obligations. Mm-hmm. So it's a weird, sticky issue, but it's a wonderful way to say, you know, those accords are unconstitutional. You can't have a treaty that's unconstitutional. You know, it's like you can't say we're going to enslave 10% of our population. Well, it's a treaty now. The hell it is. It's so unconstitutional. Yeah. It's you can't deploy that in our country because it's not the law here. It violates our constitution, and now we're going to fight it. And there's enough evidence to support it. You know, whether it's Jessica Jones season 2, where they talk about the raft and how there's like no visitation and things that would violate cruel and unusual punishment, let alone the right to counsel, let alone appeals. Right. So if you're denying people, they don't have to be citizens, but people, due process under the law, and Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, and Eighth Amendment rights are being violated, don't follow that order, because you're contributing to unconstitutional acts, which would make it an illegal order, and he would not be bound to follow it. So that's, I would be glad to represent Rhodey, because it's wrong. It's absolutely objectively wrong, and it'd be great to actually get that into court.
I could see Secretary Ross being like having a Jack Nicholson Few Good Men moment on the stand when he's testifying. He just like completely melts down and like tries to jump out of the stand and come after the defense attorney.
His nickname's Thunderbolt, and you know, you think back to the Hulk movie where they were having S.H.I.E.L.D. do mass surveillance that is like metadata monitoring, you know, but there's no FISA court involved, of all communications over the word gamma. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you didn't get a search warrant for that. And yeah, there were search warrants that covered 7 million people from the FISA court. That's still wrong. Still have a problem with that.
Right.
But they didn't bother doing that. And so he doesn't have a good civil rights upholding the Bill of Rights record anyway, even from his days in the military. So, no, not the poster boy for upholding and defending the Constitution.
Yeah.
So let's pivot. Let's go fanboy. Who's your favorite character in the MCU?
This is going to be a cop out, but I really loved Teenage Groot in this one. I thought he was this movie specific. I wouldn't say he's my favorite character in the MCU. If you had asked me as a kid and told me that all these movies were going to exist and that Spider-Man would come back into the fold, I would have told you never in 1,000 years would I not be, you know, have Spider-Man as my number one character. Spider-Man is a close second, but the way that they've developed Cap and his arc throughout the movies leading up to this, Cap by far is my number one. And I don't say that as a shill, being in the military and a fellow captain myself, but genuinely, he's my favorite.
Yeah, for me, it's Cap or Thor. And those were the books I read. Well, my brother read Cap as a kid, and I would read his. Mm-hmm. I collected Thor. So I've always really loved Thor. You know, the first couple movies were just okay. But he was great in Avengers, and what they did with Thor Ragnarok was exceptional. And I loved his arc in Infinity War. And seeing him paired with Rocket and Groot was brilliant. You know, faster rabbit. I mean, that's... Or his interaction with the Guardians. Like, it's like, you're a man. This is a pirate angel. That was so well done. It was like the right mix of humor and, you know, Quill's attempts to like try to undercut Thor constantly backfiring with like, well, or her dad killed your brother. You know, I'm going, families are complicated. Like, being this pillar of understanding was like so good.
I will say one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie has nothing to do with those characters, but Quill is talking to Gamora and they're having this like kind of heartfelt conversation, I guess. And then, I'm totally blanking on his name.
Drax.
Drax is standing right there. And how long have you been standing there? An hour. But I've trained myself. I am completely invisible to you.
No,
I almost
not.
Fell out of my seat laughing at the theater.
That was very well done. The Guardians were the right mix of humor in this. I do love Cap in this, even though his lines were limited. Like they broke up the big three. Like the big three in the Avengers always has been Thor, Iron Man, and Cap. Those are like the core Avengers, throughout the decades. Mm-hmm. And having each one of them off on a different area and then coming together, at least two out of the three came together with the side characters who were with them, worked very effectively. And the Doctor Strange, Iron Man, Spider-Man interactions I thought were very well done. I really love seeing Tony's evolution as a character, from playboy to father figure for Spider-Man. Very well done. Tony versus Thanos was excellent.
Yeah.
Great action, great fight. Everything's on the line. And yet they still have humor in it, even though it ends in a very dark place. There was silence the two times I saw it at the end. Just stunned silence. When I got home, first time seeing it, I just laid in bed and stared at the ceiling trying to figure out how do I feel.
Yeah. The kid in front of me, when it cut to Peter saying he didn't feel so good, and I'm so sad that that's become such a big meme now, because it just brings a tear to my eye every time I see it. Like, Mr. Stark, I don't feel so good. But the kid in front of me, he was probably 12 or 13, and I saw myself in him, because I was, it was Thor for you and Cap for your brother. It was Spider-Man growing up for me. And when it cut to him, I was like, my stomach dropped out and I felt this sense of dread. And the kid, the kid in front of me is like, "Not Spidey." And he said it so loud and nobody said a word to him, because everybody in that theater was thinking the exact same thing. And it just punched me right in the gut.
Yeah, that was rough. The second time I saw it, there were teenagers to my left. They were like, "No, come on." So like there was great reactions there. It's supposed to hurt. You're supposed to care. I mean, it was a bit, they bumped off people I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't expecting Black Panther. I was expecting him to be part of the solution, and I was expecting Scarlet Witch to be part of the solution. So like those were the two that shocked me the probably the most. Same with Winter Soldier. I didn't think Cap and Tony were going to die in this, because they have unresolved issues.
Yeah.
And Tony needs to give Cap back his shield. So, like the final fight that takes place, Cap's going to have his shield. And we're going to see them at full strength. And they're going to be there to avenge. And that's what they do. And it goes back to that first quote, the quote in, the first movie. Like, if we can't save the world, we'll be damn sure to avenge it.
That's a very good point. It makes me wonder whether Marvel is going to do another phase announcement like they've done in the past, where you see the slate of movies that's on the docket, or if they're going to keep that a little closer hold this time.
Well, they canceled their Hall H appearance at San Diego Comic-Con.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And that's probably because they're still working on the deal with Fox, and that today Comcast offered to like match Disney's offer for cash. So if I hope that doesn't happen, I hope Disney wins this fight, because then they'll have their full slate of characters that they can look at, because that could mean something with the Fantastic Four. It could mean something with X-Men, or at least it would give them lots of the mutant characters and aliens, or alien characters, because the deal didn't include species, but does include specific characters. So that does get a little weird. But if they
being the attorney that is like drafting that deal, how awesome is that?
If they want help, I'd gladly tag in.
me too.
Let me help you with the M&A analysis.
Pro bono, I'll add.
Sure, I can get an eDiscovery software company to help with the doc review cost on this bad boy. Let's do this. I want to help you be successful. There's that aside, I think that's why they haven't announced a lot. I mean, we know that they're working on the Spider-Man sequel. We know that Guardians 3 is in some form of development. What are the others? They're not going to bump off. I mean, everyone who turned the dust will be back. I mean, they're in the Soul Stone. You know, the wild card is, say, Gamora and Loki. You know, Heimdall. Heimdall's dead. Everyone who died prior to the death wave is dead. At least that's conventional wisdom. Everyone who turned to dust will come back. Like, that's what happened in the comics, because they're probably in the Soul Stone.
It makes me, the end credits scene makes me very, very much look for, not that I wasn't before, but I'm very much looking forward to Captain Marvel, even more so now. Also, because Brie Larson is a badass, but.
Yeah, and love the fact she was flying with the Air Force, and she's researched the character. She seems very into it and very respectful to the source material. And, she would kick ass.
That's next year, right?
Yes. Because Avengers, the sequel to this, is May 2019. So it's sometime before that. I don't remember when. And it takes place in the 90s. Captain Marvel will be interesting, because she's a dynamic character, and they're also going to have the Kree Captain Marvel, who she took his name. And God, I mean, like, that's such a complicated story arc to do, so I'm not quite sure how they're going to consolidate it. They have all kinds of options for what they can do, and I'm sure it'll be good and creative. But again, it ends with hope, despite mass death. And hopefully not too many airplanes had pilots who turned to dust, because then that adds to the body count. God, just think of traffic on an intergalactic scale.
Yeah. Thanos is going down for this one.
So in the comics, there was the big Marvel 2-in-1 that was, you know, the end of the Thanos War. And that was, you know, his main villain, you know, antagonist that were up against Thanos were Captain Marvel, the original.
Right.
And Adam Warlock. And Adam Warlock is killed, but he and his compatriots are in the Soul Stone. And in the final battle, it's Warlock comes out of the Soul Stone and turns Thanos to stone. I mean, it's a brilliant slugfest of like everyone versus Thanos. Because again, Thanos worships death, and that's what he's after, and that's how the end game is stopped. When they do the Infinity Gauntlet, you know, in that fight, you know, eventually it's Nebula who gets the gauntlet and reverses everything. So again, we're in the middle. It's going to be okay.
Plenty more to come.
Yeah. Nebula, my guess is Nebula and Tony take the Guardian ship to get back to Earth. So they're not just hanging out there. Tony's still super injured, so that's also not good. So we'll see. We'll see. We shall see.
I'm excited about it. Plenty. Between this and Star Wars, if I hopped in a time machine and went back and told my 10-year-old self that every year you'd get, you know, 1 to 2 Marvel movies and a Star Wars movie, I would call you a complete total liar and, you know, a time traveling freak. Get out of here. Like, never in my wildest dreams did I think we'd live in a world where, you know, 10 years you get 20 Marvel movies and what are we on? Number coming up on 4 Star Wars movies as of tomorrow?
It's
phenomenal.
We live in a golden age. We are profoundly lucky. I'm like, this is what happens when Gen Xers are in charge. it's like, no, we were denied and now we're going to finish this on our terms. It's going to go for another decade. So
you guys are going to pay up twice a year, 3 times a year. You're going to buy popcorn too.
It's a wonderful thing. And like, we get TV shows and it's all good. So I'm quite enthusiastic about the world we live in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand why people were sad after Infinity War, but it's the middle of the story.
Yeah.
And we don't know what part 2 is going to be named.
The middle has to be the down part.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, I just, they'll knock the next one out of the park as well. So we'll see. We shall see. So with that, everyone, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy our podcast, please leave a review. We'll have some other exciting announcements about shows that we're going to be at. Jess will be at Escape Velocity in D.C. For a Star Wars presentation. I'll be at San Francisco Comic-Con for Star Wars, Kaiju, and Universal Monsters. And there should be others as well. So stay tuned. Oh, and Thomas, you got a nerd night in August?
Yeah, if you're on the East Coast in range of Philadelphia, I will be at Nerd Night Philadelphia presenting on Star Wars on August 1st. And you can follow me at Thomas L. Harper and get all the details, but put it on your radar.
Sounds good. So everyone, stay geeky. Stay geeky, America.